My name is Chris Temple, and I'm a film director at Optimist. And I am panicked about the future of financial advice on the internet and social media.
That's me, Howie.
Jensen.
What's up, my man?
Happy summer.
Happy summer to you, too.
Ethan.
Lindsay.
What up?
What's going on?
How's your summer going?
It's good. I'm still here.
You're still here. Yes. And you are heading into what year this fall in school?
Junior.
Junior means, for Max, that means seventh year in college. What's that for a regular kid?
Third year.
Third year in college. You know, speaking of college, do you know, I think it'll be done by the time your kids, I think it'll be done.
I hope so.
Yeah. I think it'll be done. You know what everybody should be doing? Making content. And that's what today's show is about. You know, you should be 8 years old. You'll be TikToking. You'll be AI, mid-journeying. My guest today is a filmmaker. So it's a special guest. He, Cole called me through a friend of mine, Chris Camillo. I think it was at the Phoenix Open. It was really loud. You're not supposed to use your phone. A lot of players were giving me the finger. And it was during COVID. It was during that break in COVID, I think, where they were letting you do stuff, I think. And Chris called me and pitched me on a movie. Chris Temple's my guest today, filmmaker, Optimist Productions or Optimist Studios. He'll correct me. And he said, hey, it's Chris. I got a movie idea for you. We're going to make a GameStop movie. I think the GameStop shenanigans happened. And we got into it. I don't know, because it was a good referral from my friend Chris, who's LP in our fund and a friend of ours and really good investor. And we had a long discussion. I said, I don't really like the GameStop angle. We chatted. And he'll fill us in on some stuff because I'm 58 and I have one view of history. And Chris will remember more because he's younger. But he's a 34-year-old filmmaker. We had his movie, I'm an executive producer and a small investor and not a star in it. Chris explained to me how the world works. We'll talk about a little bit about that. But he pitched me on this movie. The movie was out, you know, sold out world premiere at Tribeca Film Festival in June. And it's really been just an incredible ride. And Chris and his team built this and made this incredible film called This Is Not Financial Advice. So people have seen it, but I wanted to go behind the scenes and talk to Chris and get his view of making a movie, a documentary like this, and how hard it was. So let's get Chris on the phone. Chris Temple.
Hey, how's it going, Howie?
Good. I like it, Howie. This is not financial advice. When did you come up with that name?
You know, that name was... Once it stuck for us kind of throughout production, we just kept coming back to it. It felt like it encapsulated this whole world of the collision of the internet and money coming together. And of course, is a very common slogan that people use on social media, you know, don't take my advice. This is not financial advice. So they don't get sued as they go through this. So it's sort of a play on, you know, on what this world is, that it's very difficult to actually find good financial advice on the internet. And especially in a time where so much of this financial advice is dominated by social media.
Do you recall, same as me, you had talked to Chris Camillo, did he just give you my number and you called me?
Yeah, he told me about, you know, this guy, Howard, and I was like, oh, who is this? Do I really want to talk to this guy?
That sounds like my mom.
No, so, you know, we had an early call when we were still trying to figure out what this film was all about. And I think at the time, there was a lot of energy and excitement about GameStop. And I think together,
so 2020, late 2020,
yeah, sort of late 2020, early 2021. And, you know, we were talking to a lot of different people, a lot of new investors coming into the space. And I think you and I quickly kind of learned and figured out that GameStop was just a blip in this bigger story and bigger narrative that we were seeing about really, I think, what is the psychology of the investor psyche during, you know, these euphoric highs of 2020, 2021, and then eventually what became the crushing depths of 2022, 2023, following investors through that journey. And that's a more timeless story. And I think what you and I were always searching for was, how do we make something that can last and isn't just a retelling of a single moment on the internet?
Yeah, because when I was telling you, I was like, oh, you know, the only book I liked, unless you read a book about fraud and degenerates, which is what everything is, you know, I call it the degenerate economy, but you and I know it's not degenerate economy. It's just the tools exist for you to be a degenerate, whether it's heroin or trading or fantasy sports or Ambien. I mean, everything's there. I mean, the best line in the movie, I have to say, even though I would ask for his autograph, is Fat Jewish's line, where he basically says, you know, 20 years ago, if you didn't want to blow yourself up, you sat on your couch. And flash forward 20 years ago, you can blow a lot of shit up from your couch or something like that. And I'm like,
yeah, he says it's never been easier to lose money from your couch. You can lose the most money just sitting on your couch with your iPhone. You don't even have to go to a Harrah's in Atlantic City anymore.
So I'm saying, how can you not be which would be a great name for the movie. I think he came up with the best name for the movie, because we had riffed on the meme economy, which was better than other names. And I guess it just never really, I think it would have hurt in the end.
Well, I think something that we liked about this film was, like, this isn't, you know, like an academic look back at something or trying to explain some phenomenon. Like, you're living it for multiple years following four regular Americans who are starting to get out into investing. And two of them have massive risk appetites and are kind of YOLOing it all, trying to get rich overnight. And then two are kind of the foil characters trying to take the slow and steady, boring approach of tried and true investing. And I think you can actually learn just as much from each of them, because you can learn what not to do in investing. And I think, you know, for many of us, I think Josh Brown in the film has an amazing quote that's like, you know, honestly, he's learned the most from the mistakes that he's made as an investor.
Yes.
And that is true for many of us.
Yeah, we had this 15-year period where the mistakes were covered up, called, you know, post-GFC to 2022. And even if you weren't in financial stocks, even 2006 when YouTube came out, so you had this endless period of growth. And so you have this false, I wouldn't say false narrative, this false sense of invincibility.
You know, think about what the economy was when we started this film in early 2021. I mean, at that period of time, you know, you've got 20 million new investors coming into the economy. Everything is booming. You know, 96% of all stocks had gone up over this period.
Yeah.
You've got, you know, crypto and meme coins shooting up. Dogecoin is, you know, eventually ends up going up 6,000% that year. I mean, the returns were eye-watering.
Yeah.
And the response that happens for many people of new investors on that, if that's the only part of the economy they know, is that I'm a genius and I'm really good at investing, and not that, you know, this happens to be a cyclical moment of a booming economy.
Besides me, who's the most interesting? Besides me, so the fourth most interesting. Why are you laughing, Canoon?
Because you're so funny.
Mute that out. So, so besides me, who is the most interesting? Because I kind of hope I guided you on what to read. You started reading my blog, Josh Morgenhousel. There's so many smart people that you had in the film. I know Josh, and I can talk to him anytime, and Morgenhousel. So Fat Jewish, I never followed him on Instagram. That was a great cameo. Who do you think is the best at not giving financial advice?
Oh, man, there's so many great people who help support on the film.
In terms of, like, just someone you read and listen to and goes, I get that.
I mean, so I do think that the Fat Jewish was the most unexpectedly really, really important part of the film to me, and why I think it's difficult to get good financial advice online is you've got social media algorithms that are going to promote the story of the guy who makes $3 million, but they don't tell the story of all the people who might be losing along the way. And, you know, the Fat Jewish really helped bring that to life, as well as actually the guy who founded the term FOMO, Patrick McGinnis, who's a great expert in the film, who we had some really good conversations with to just understand the depth and complexity of what is a simple psychological concept, but it really messes with all of our heads while we're, you know, while we're trying to make money and save money. There's this one moment in the film that that's one of my favorites, Howard, is the, you know, we're filming for a day with the main character, Pro. He called himself Pro the Doge.
He should call himself Putt.
The Dogecoin millionaire. And, you know, this was in a moment in 2021 where the price of Dogecoin was really booming. He had taken out all of his savings. He'd maxed out his credit cards. He'd taken out cash advances. He put all his life savings into Dogecoin. And he starts riding this up to 1 million, 1.5 million. He's still refusing to sell the cash, right? So that's where we are in time.
And you're giving it, we're setting him up to get advice. Like it's not like we're encouraging him on. We're sitting him around. People are like, dude,
you know, he's going to hear from the best experts in the world, having conversations with everyone, you know, friends, family, his mom's yelling at him to sell, you know, he's got it from all sides. But, you know, there's this one day we're filming with him and he goes to Costco for, you know, pick up some celery juice. He's a big celery juice drinker. And, you know, we're at Costco for an hour and we come back and he checks the price of Dogecoin in the 1 hour that we've gone to Costco. And he'd made $179,000 in the 1 hour that we were filming at Costco. You know, and here I am, you know, sweating, holding this heavy camera. I'm a, you know, broke filmmaker trying to make a documentary here. And I'm like, oh my God, $179,000 an hour. And of course, that's going to trigger all of these psychological things for me of feeling FOMO, of feeling like, well, I should get in on this. I should, you know, I don't want to miss out. And that was one of the most frustrating parts of the whole film, was actually holding true, even though I knew better, just continually following good financial advice.
So I should have filmed you filming him.
Absolutely.
This is not financial advice. So what did you FOMO into some Doge yourself? That's not in the movie, but did you?
Yeah, I made some pretty poor financial decisions throughout the process of making this film. And I mean, I totally got sucked into this world of speculation and of trying to get rich overnight, because when you see other people doing it, you feel like, well, I'm smarter than them. I should be able to do it too. And I think that's the, you know, that's the chase that happens when you're comparing yourself to 7 billion people online and only a few of the stories that are the ones making it big. So I think making the film to me was super cathartic. I got to sit with these amazing, you know, interviews with, Morgan Housel, Josh Brown, Genevieve Rock Dechter, you know, some of the great YouTubers, you know, Meet Kevin and Graham Stephan and all of them. And I just learned actually how to avoid these psychological triggers. And then it's part of why I want to share the film, is I want people to be smarter with money and to have that control and to, be better as they move into the future.
And do I have potential as an exec producer? But rate me, who's the best of all time? Who's an exec producer that's like fame?
I mean, Steven Spielberg, or, you know, there's some filmmakers like Spielberg that are close to you, Lindzen.
Yeah.
But like, I mean, I think your grace and class that you had throughout.
I mean, I have the biggest nose of I have the biggest mole of an executive producer on my face. So, but I think I gave you good advice, right? Like through the whole thing, I think I steered you. My job was to, you taught me a lot about filmmaking. You were like, hey, if you're going to invest and we're going to be in a documentary, you can't be in the documentary. Why does that not work?
Well, you know, I want the film, this is an independent documentary. I want it to feel objective, and I don't want to feel like my hand is being forced to push a certain narrative it's not sponsored by any companies. Right. And if I had you in there also as an investor, you know, you've got to, you know, now your incentives are different of you as an expert. So none of the people who are in the film as experts have any sort of financial stake in it. And I think that's an important part of, you know, getting truth out there through the film. But no, I think, you know, the process of making these films, as you learned along the way, are crazy, right? I mean, we filmed probably close to 300 hours over 2.5 years with this film. You know, so many interviews we did. I probably had conversations with 300, 400 plus
investors. Well, so many that didn't make it in that I introduced you to, right?
Like, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, so much of it is on background, right? I mean, you've got to synthesize a story and all of these themes down to something that's only 90 minutes.
So why four people? Explain to people, like, I always like, could we just make it two? What's the formula? So what are like the parameters of why you do things?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. It's all in service of the one film, right? So I've got 90 minutes and it needs to be an arc, right? So there's three acts to the film, and it needs to have a dramatic tension point at the end of act two, and you need to sort of have something that, people want to watch, right? It isn't a podcast. It's not like a boring podcast like this, right? It's got to have a real story to it. It can't just be wandering, different conversations. It goes on a real journey. Part of it is you film all these different stories and they have to work well together. So I didn't need, the main character, Pro, was an amazing character who had, YOLO'd his life savings into Dogecoin, and he was basically the most extreme example of one of these investors that we've been talking with. I didn't need two pros. I didn't need two people who were also gambling their life savings into Dogecoin. I needed to have stories that were balancing one another and allowing people different entry points into the film. So Pro is one example. There's another story in there that's of a dad in Indiana who does make some really big risky bets. Whew. And he ends up selling his house and putting it all into Mana, which is another crypto coin. And he moves his kids into a storage unit for a little while. And his wife divorces him over these financial decisions he's making. Yeah. And you can really see why he was in there was to see the true consequences of what's happening with this. If you're a single guy in your 20s YOLOing your money, that's very different than if you're a dad of three kids.
Yeah, that one was the most interesting to me because of this degenerate economy, parents involving their kids. It was awful to watch. Not because I think he's a bad guy, just because he had the fever. Now, my idea for more nudity, how do you decide how little or how much nudity? That was where I was shooting for more nudity, but why no nudity?
Well, once we took you out as being an expert, it wasn't worth, having a nude scene anymore.
I had written myself as a romantic love interest, so they were smartly took me out of that. So anyway, so really the idea of following, I think what was so interesting the way you piece this together, he gets in the New York Times. He calls you, I'm going to be in the New York Times. So now you have to run the crew over and film this really interesting scene because none of it's made up. This is all really happening.
Yeah.
So that's cool. A lot of stuff happened that we got lucky, right? Everything was compressed, right? If you go with the GameStop story, there's no movie, right?
Yeah.
You would have spent 2 years or 10 GameStop movies. What I'm most proud about is that you created something about fear and greed, which were still all you and your team, not me. And you created Jesse Livermore's story in a digital era. And people read Jesse Livermore 100 years later, right? And it applies to so many people. So you've just modernized this whole thing. And just a simple decision of making it about one event. Well, I guess you could still make a great movie. And now the Hollywood's making a GameStop movie.
I think the difference, why I didn't want to, you and I talked this through a lot. You were really helpful on it was, GameStop was telling a story about the past. At the time we were starting that film, it would have been a retelling of an internet moment. And so in many ways, what that starts to look like visually in a documentary is a whole bunch of screenshots of headlines, a whole bunch of screens of social media posts. And it's not really a movie anymore. It's kind of just a retelling of something. It's sort of a news story. And so what we were kind of looking for here, and what the hard part, as you were saying, is we didn't know what was going to happen. We started following a few individuals, a guy who YOLO'd his life savings on Dogecoin. And you're like, where's this going to go? And we didn't know how long, if he was going to make any money, if it was going to, what would happen with that story. And I think I'm glad that, we had, the investors were game to follow this all the way through to a conclusion, because I think it would have been really a shame to have only followed the rise of this story, which was something that, some other films and people were just covering the story of the boom. But we had to sit in this and just know that at some point, this is going to come crashing down, right? Yeah. It can't go up forever. And so I'm glad we took that extra year to really see this through and add the complexity of what starts to happen when the money goes down. Because again, whole new wave of psychological triggers. When you're sitting with Pro and he used to have $3 million in Dogecoin and now he only has two, he doesn't want to sell because it used to be three. And he's thinking about all the money he left on the table. And, Morgan Housel's book, The Psychology of Money, has been such a backbone to, a lot of the themes that we bring to life in this movie.
Yeah, and I think I introduced you to him. So he...
You did.
Yeah, he just knows how to say things in English, much like Fat Jewish, much like Josh Brown, because where I feel this movie will live on is much like Jesse Livermore. This is about fear and greed. Where we got a little bit lucky, obviously, is how fast it unraveled, because he could be going on still. And then they look like geniuses, not that they're smart or dumb. This isn't about smart or dumb. This is about fear and greed. Like you said, well, I'm smarter than him. And that's the poison. It's not about how smart you are. Sometimes it's just about your risk management, how you manage your own emotions, and it's basically fear and greed and what you can live with.
And look, there are so many systemic elements here that Morgan Housel, you know, was great to bring to light that, you know, you've got many people who, you know, almost 50% of Americans don't have $600 in savings at any given time. There's a ton of wealth inequality in this country. So if you've got people who feel like they don't have much option, why not take a huge financial risk? And you often see this, that those who have the least are those that are willing to take the biggest financial risks. And obviously you see it with lottery tickets. You know, people who are buying lottery tickets are those that don't have that much. And, you know, Pro is a great example of that in this film.
Yeah. And what's your take now that you know what you know? What do you think of, you know, the Robin Hoods, the crypto, the Elon Musk? Because there's this great scene. Oh, let's quickly do, and I knew it was the top. I think I wrote about it on my blog at the time. Like Elon Musk being on Saturday Night Live, like right after this Dogecoin run was like the top. Now, he didn't know that, obviously. He was getting advice as to like, dude, you got to sell before Elon appears on Saturday Night Live. What was his mood, true mood going into that? And now that you edited it in such a way that we know what we know, I think that should be people's biggest learning point.
Yeah, no. So you've got this moment. I mean, Pro, the main character, he's almost at $3 million. That night, Elon's going to be on SNL. It feels like he can't lose, right? And it's just going to the moon. And he's getting reinforced again by all of these friends sending him messages, all these people on Twitter and Reddit telling him he's a genius, telling him to hold. And the community aspect of this is really big in this space. And it's part of why I got sucked into it, too, is other people telling me to buy certain things or... we were all in it together. You know, some of these, this kind of conversation that happens from a community level, I think affected Pro a lot in his decisions. And then, but you know, that day he was all hype, right? I mean, the money's just rolling in. And I think, you know, again, another Morgan Housel thing is, you know, he talks a lot about the moving goalpost where, you know, for Pro, this guy who lived in a 180 square foot apartment, a Brazilian immigrant, his mom works as a house cleaner, never had much money to his name in his whole life. Now he's sitting on $3 million and all of a sudden it's not enough, right? And and that's where the greed comes in. And for then it's like, well, it just needs to get a little bit higher, right? To get to a little bit higher place. And that's a quote he has in the film. And you get caught up in that and you shoot to, oh, well, maybe I can just eke a little bit more. And then it all comes crashing down.
And by the way, for people listening, that happens to all of us. I had a Solana run. Even though I've done well in other things, I had this fake Solana money. Not fake. I mean, Solana, you know, it's not like I'm involved in Solana, but it changed my perspective on what's enough. I thought I had sold enough. He'd sold nothing. So I don't know what the hell's the matter with this kid. I slap him around, but slap some celery out of him. I know to sell. That could be the way I'm wired. But obviously, in hindsight, I didn't sell enough.
Yeah.
He did not sell. So how is he dealing with that today?
So one of the interesting turns of the film, you know, you talk about how we don't know where these stories are going, is that, you know, what Pro ended up doing is actually leveraging his attention and fame of being the Dogecoin millionaire into a brand. So he started a YouTube. He's got hundreds of thousands of subscribers on YouTube and Twitter. And then brands and other meme coins started paying him to promote their different coins. And so that's where you start to realize there's a little bit of a house of cards that's being built on, you know, in this world, is that Pro is then telling everyone to buy Floki coin or another coin that's out there. And really, the only reason he's saying that is because Floki coin gave him $150,000 of Floki coin. So he's got to pump it up to get money himself. And it's a way of making money. And so, you know, he's made about almost $700,000 in sponsorship deals from different coins and other crypto companies as an influencer now. And so that's where, again, I really like this title, This Is Not Financial Advice, because it really starts to interrogate, you know, what is financial advice on the internet? Who are you following? And to help people be really careful about, you know, what content's being sponsored, what's a scam? How do you be really careful about the voices you're looking to on the internet? I mean, like, definitely don't listen to this podcast, for example.
Yeah, don't listen to this. Well, don't worry. No one is. Look at him talking smack. What the fuck? Executive producer. What I wrote about recently is Cramer 2.0. I hated Jim Cramer. I'm like, I'm going to solve this. And the internet will fix this. Well, now we got 1,000 Jim Cramers, you know? And they all look different than Jim, right? Different skin, different sizes, different weights, different shapes. So we live in this era, and that's what I want to talk to you about. Like, I interrupted myself with the other questions, is so how do you feel about all this now? Like,
yeah.
You now have, I grew up around this when my dad was a speculator. So I ran from it for 20 years. And then, of course, you know, the next boom comes along and I get swept up in it in the 90s. It's like fire. You can't avoid it. So how do you feel about this whole thing now that you've seen Flaky Coin or whatever it's called? You've seen the investor become the, what do you call it? The shiller. And yep. I'm not judging, because we see it at every level of billionaire status, whether you're Ackman or Chamath or David Sachs. People can't help themselves. They get caught up in the dispensing advice. So where is your head around this and investing?
I mean, I think, like, no matter what, when you look back over the past few years, it is so good that we are giving people access to financial markets. I mean, we've got such a wealth inequality problem in this country. You've got, you know, almost 90% of stocks owned by 10% of Americans. That's a problem, you know, and I think we need to find ways to bring new people into investing. And that's great. I love that there's millions of new people pouring in. And so then how do we help give people the tools to be smart investors in that world, and new investors coming in who might not have had the opportunities growing up of their dad having been in this world, or, you know, grown up around the conversations around money. And that's where I think, you know, this is this double-edged sword here, is that YouTube is an amazing platform that's empowering so many new, you know, making it really easy for people to learn about finance. I mean, I learned so much from TikTok and YouTube about different financial tools and different tricks around compound interest and thinking about real estate, and that's amazing. And young people are getting that access because it's not being taught in schools. But on the other side of that coin, there's a lot of risk, and the risk is getting amplified when you've got all these scams and different, you know, kind of elements of FOMO popping up with social media.
So you studied economics.
Yeah, so I was an accidental filmmaker. I was an econ major. My first film was about the financial lives of families living under a dollar a day, and kind of how people survive with such a small amount of money. And that was a Netflix film we made back in 2015. And then I kind of, yeah, film has become a tool to talk about these issues that we really care about at Optimist.
And so tell me a little bit about Optimist. It's a great name.
Thank you. Yeah. So, you know, my co-founder and co-director on this film, Zach Ingrassi, and I started this with a few friends back in 2012. When we were graduating college. And really, you know, it's a nonprofit production company. We make movies, and then we hope that the movies can have some sort of a positive impact on the world. So for this film, for example, we're building out a big financial education campaign around the film and doing different partnerships that can help bring financial education to people who don't have it. And we hope to reach 3 million students with the film. And, you know, more broadly, kind of why we're named Optimist is, you know, we see these stories of people all over the world who are kind of fighting to make a world a better place. And we believe that that's possible. And so we're kind of trying to elevate different stories that we think can do that.
And we're working together on some big media ideas around this as well. Chris and Howard are teaming up.
Yeah, this isn't the last time. I don't know why I wasn't scared away from you, but no, it's been
well, there's always time to run.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's been so good.
It's like FOMO.
I think what we realized in the edit, Howard, was like, you know, we had so many stories we wanted to tell. And that was one of the hard parts as we were having our conversations. It was like, well, can you include that? Can you include that? And it's like, well, that's its own film. And oh, that's its own podcast. And there's so much content out there. So I think, yes, there's so much opportunity to create more, you know, more content together as we move forward across financial topics. And, you know, whether it's films or podcasts or other areas. And The interest is there. The interest is absolutely there, and the need is too.
Yeah, the interest is there. Every financial story is always about the Madoffs and the fraud. But there's only one way to do fraud. You promise more, that, you know what I mean? The, you know, the Ponzi breaks down. Success is like the million births, you know, like, I don't know, million fathers, whatever they say. And, you know, you look at the Nike book, the Jordan story wasn't really even in the book. And that book's like a Bible. So great companies have great stories. You know, you don't just have to talk about Bernie Madoff and GameStop, you know. Great stories exist out there about financial success. You know, the machine is just getting going on that. So how did you come up with the next one, the Ethereum movie?
Yeah, so we've also been directing a, with again, my co-director Zach Ingrassi and our producer Carrie Weprin and Jenna Kelly, a feature documentary about Ethereum and its founder Vitalik Buterin. And that we've also been filming for a couple years now. And has been a really interesting just deep dive into understanding the world of Ethereum, how this came to be, and its founder, who is, you know, at the center of this as a young, you know, crypto billionaire genius, right? And you've got, you know, in the era of, you know, following through as the SBF collapse happens, and there's certain other elements happening in the whole ecosystem, you know, we've just gotten to be with them and follow it in real time. So we're not exactly sure when that film will be completed yet, but you know, it's in a similar way. It's kind of bringing this independent, character-driven kind of approach to a financial topic.
And are you bullish on Ethereum? Now that you know as much as you know, or you know, don't know anything? What do you think?
This is not financial advice. This is not financial.
No, sorry. Do you own some Ethereum?
I do own some Ethereum. I think you know, I do think that there's, you know, crypto, I think, has gotten, you know, what we saw in our film is that there's a lot of noise and 95% of these companies and coins are going to fail. And there's a lot of people are just using it to try to get rich overnight. But I think there are some elements that are really interesting to explore and kind of psychological or philosophical, sorry, kind of questions about decentralization that I do think are very interesting. And Ethereum is, I think, on the forefront of pushing some of those boundaries.
Yeah, there's no doubt. Like, Bitcoin and Ethereum stand out in a world of centralized behemoths, whether it's Comcast or Apple or Salesforce or JP Morgan. I just feel it's just came along as kind of financial religion. It's like, here's some alternatives. Go, you know, code is the language that birthed these new religions, and they're going to take many forms and factions. I mean, look at all the alternative realities to how the Earth was formed.
Yeah,
Forgetting science, which is the only one, but all the other ones.
No, and so, the forces that, you know, of why people care about Ethereum or care about Bitcoin are still there. So yeah, whether it ends up being Bitcoin or Ethereum or something else that, you know, is around 10 years from now, who knows? I mean, it's like the early internet again, right? I mean, you don't know what's going to actually of the companies or coins will last, but I think you're seeing... you know, you're seeing an energy there that, and so many people are interested in it, that that's not going away. And what's interesting is it really hasn't gone away even as the price crashes have happened. You know, we've been continuing to do interviews with many, many people in the whole ecosystem, and there's still a lot of energy, and even a whole meme coin surge, you know, that was happening in May and June of, you know, tons of coins shooting back up again.
Yeah. Well, this goes to what you said, though, you know, with access comes other kinds of problems. As you build, you know, you build one toll road, you got one toll road, but if there, that toll road allows everybody to do stuff, you've got chaos. You know, it's going to take a while but I'm really glad that you got to tell this story and that the timing of the story kind of melded to tell a full story, the up and the down.
Yeah.
And I don't know, like, that may not happen again. So that's what's also exciting about it, that compressed, that just the timing and all those decisions that let you catch the up and the down. Ethereum's a much different story. It's a story about a person and kind of a revolution versus this was a story of fear and greed, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And what other topics excite you besides finance?
I mean, at Optimus, we do a bunch of films across a lot of different social issues. I mean, we got a film right now about food insecurity in America. We got a film about criminal justice that are two short films that are kind of releasing in festivals and things right now. And we got a few ideas that we're moving forward. I do think, you know, what's interesting is all of these different issues are, there's so much intersectionality, right? I mean, I think something like financial education or financial empowerment is an underpinning of a lot of different topics, right? And then all of this stuff is connected. And I think that's what's fun about popping between different film topics. We've made films about immigration, about refugees, about all of these different topics. And you see how connected all of these different stories are. And it helps, I think, hopefully inform us as better filmmakers where we're working with, you know, Pro is a Brazilian immigrant and being able to, you know, understand the context of his family and what he's going through. And, you know, from spending 5 years making an immigration film, made this film better. So I'm hoping that they all just kind of layer up to make, you know, make every film really strong.
For the audience, can we talk about budget, like to make a movie like this in Ethereum or no?
Yeah, we can talk about this one. So, I mean, I think, you know, the average documentary, you know, for a feature doc has been coming in at like, you know, about 800 to 1.5 million, you know, and I think those are, you know, those are getting higher in recent years as I think the expectations of what people want from a streamer and from a documentary are becoming really big. Like we're expecting these things to be super cinematic and shot in 4K and they're beautiful and all this stuff. But, you know, remind that there's a lot of pressure on us as filmmakers to elevate that and really try to compete with the great narrative stuff that's out there. But, you know, at the end of the day, like we're running around with a camera trying to capture real life. And there's only so much you can, you know, the camera might not be, you know, might shake sometimes because that's it's real life and you're running after someone, you know, down the street. And so, you know, I do hope that, you know, I think you can make a doc in all sorts of different ways. You don't have to spend a ton of money on it, but I think that that's becoming the expectation.
What's like the highest grossing doc? Is there such a thing of all time?
Yeah. I mean, some of the biggest, you know, again, it was similar in 2021. You were getting these huge sales of documentaries for, you know, $12, $15 million, coming out of Sundance and elsewhere. So, you know, those are usually in that range. If you're doing docuseries, you know, there's series that have done super well, but, you know, platforms like Netflix are not giving out viewer data. So, you know, you take something like Making a Murderer and you don't actually know how many views, you know, your film may have gotten on Netflix.
You know, but if you're like A24, you can probably negotiate to get all that.
Yeah, they're a pretty closed box. So, you know, I've been hearing it's quite difficult to get any of that data from unless, you know, it's actually.
Yeah, we don't tell them how many people or persons watch this podcast. That's how you why you agreed to come on. So
exactly.
Did you have fun doing this? Like, obviously, you do love your job, but it's a grind, man. I couldn't do what you do. You don't, do you consider it a grind? Just slugging around waiting for the story to happen?
I mean, it's a patience game, right? I mean, you're out there holding a camera, filming, you know, every day, trying to capture this story as it unfolds. And it has been so fun. I mean, we've got such an amazing team. We brought together, you know, so many people gave their heart and so much passion to bringing this film to life. And you know, and it has been so, so much fun. And I think, you know, more than maybe other films in the past, I've learned so much myself about my own finances, my own financial decisions that, you know, now I'm quick to hand out financial advice to others in my life as a result of all the books that I've read through and all the interviews we've done.
But you, at least you have a whole new network. And what's the path to me holding an Oscar? Is there a path?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think the Oscar is a...
And would I be invited? Could I run up on stage in a red Speedo and
as long as you don't slap me.
So hang on, is there a path? Like, what is, like, anything's possible. This is what I love. People don't know, but like, it's not bragging. It's just a miracle, the internet, right? Like, I hated my job. YouTube comes out and I write a show that gets bought by CBS.
Yeah.
You know, I hate Bloomberg, or I can't afford Bloomberg, so Twitter helps me create stock twits, you know? And I love movies, and now I'm a part of a movie for not a lot of money.
Totally.
And so might as well dream. So what is there a, like, we're in Tribeca. We did it. We've been there. What's the path post-Tribeca? How do you get in the Academy, or how do you get picked? Do you have to win one of these?
So you do a theatrical premiere and release in New York and LA, and that makes you eligible. And then I think what's great is, you know, then a lot of it is about energy. And like you said, the internet makes things happen. And it moves so quickly now that I think, you know, this film, what we've loved is that it's felt like it's a film of the internet, not about the internet. And I think it's been, the reactions have just been so great, just seeing how regular people are excited to share it and be a part of it. And, you know, a lot of corporate sponsors are hosting events and screenings and all the YouTubers are talking about it and pushing it out there. And I think that energy and that grassroots energy is just, you know, is how you can make a splash these days and not try to just wait around for, you know, and assuming that if you make a good product,
Hollywood will discover you.
Yeah, exactly. No, like let's hustle. And I think it's sometimes it's hard as filmmakers because you've put 3 years of your life into this film. You finally finished it and you're like, oh, can I just pass it off?
No, right? now the work starts.
But that's really, you're right. That's like the phase two, right? And that's where you begin into really getting out there and evangelizing your work. And it's what's, this is the most fun too, because you're like, these are all the reasons why I made the film I now get to share and talk about. And you get to share the piece of art that you made and with millions of people. And it's such a global audience too. I mean, think about, the millions of investors all over the world that are on StockTwits, on Reddit, on all these platforms and are excited to, you know, watch a piece like this.
Well, what we learned, and I learned it first with Wallstrip, is, yeah, it's fun to make something, but if you don't have the studios and everybody behind you, your work just begins after making it. And the better your work is, the more stressful it is because there's no guarantee anybody sees it. So be careful what you wish for. The internet is two-edged. You know, it gives you the ability to share, doesn't give you the right or ability to make sure anybody sees it.
It's very true. It's the attention economy.
The attention economy. All right, so I'm going to let you go. Congrats to you and the team, and it's just fantastic to be able to be part of something that makes it to Tribeca. What's the best film festival? Is it Sundance or Tribeca?
You know, for documentary, Sundance is still seen as the premier spot to be at. But I think for this film, Tribeca was such an amazing place in New York City. You know, the world premiere sold out in hours, and you know, it's a financial hub of the world, and it was a great place to kind of have a financial topic like this. So we're, you know, super thrilled and thankful to Tribeca for it as a launching point. And if people want to, you know, get more involved or kind of be a part of the, you know, the campaign that we're running, you can come to, you know, timfafilm.com, you know, this is not financial advice film.com. And, you know, there's a lot of different resources and ways to bring the film to your own communities, watch it, and find a bunch of resources to be a better, you know, better investor and deal with your money better.
All right. You are the man. Chris, say hi to the team. Excited to work on some more media stuff with you and some other ideas. And we'll talk to you soon.
Awesome. Yeah. Big thanks, Howard, for all your help on the film and making this thing happen. And appreciate you.
You got it, man. K-Nut.
Hey.
Ethan, so you're 19. You liked the movie.
Yeah, it was a really good one.
And you're not just saying that. What do you like about it?
Well, I see a lot of this in my own personal life, but, you know, amongst friends and whatnot. So I understand the FOMO.
You gamble a little bit.
I don't gamble.
But you invest.
I invest. So, yeah, I guess I gamble.
And you your blog is called?
The Daily Breakout.
It's great. He's right in Knut.
Amazing.
Knut's investing strategy is, hey, Howard. There's an app called Hey, Howard. What are you doing?
Yep.
And
it's worked well for
smart.
Me.
That's like Max. Hey, Dad, you're doing fine. I think what's cool about this story is it's timeless. Back to probably the beginning of time. And it won't happen again. You can't make this again. So Chris is pretty much a genius for, and his team, obviously, for having to pay. This easily could have been a GameStop. I wouldn't have been involved, but it easily could have been a GameStop movie. And right. This thing it never would have happened. So by serious decisions, he comes up with this and the doji guy falls in his lap. You can't make up this character. No. The celery juice and the, you know, but the fear and greed. Doesn't matter how different he was. When Elon came on, he thought his account was going to be $10 million. And that is wild. So it's good to catch up with Chris.
Yes.
Everybody, I'm going to make sure everybody goes to see this movie or at least spreads where we'll cut and splice this thing. There's just so many nuggets in this 90 minutes of a story. It's heart-wrenching, exciting, sad. Well, mostly sad, but especially hearing how he's flogging other coins. But lots to learn here. Canute?
I think it's important to mention to everyone listening that you just check out the description on this, and there's going to be links to where you can see this movie.
Yeah. And it'll be all over the internet in terms of cutting it up, but just to get the whole essence of this thing, he's got pretty much a masterpiece going in human behavior. So you were listening to Panic with Friend, where Canute and I sit down with, this time a filmmaker, but he's an entrepreneur and a product guy, obviously. So we sit down with entrepreneurs, founders, venture capitalists, traders. People just love getting shit done, GSD. And you can search the Panic Podcast on Spotify, YouTube, Google, Amazon, Apple. Search my name, Howard Lindzen, or Panic with Friends. Subscribe, and you will get one of these podcasts every week from us. Have a great week.
Howard Lindzen is the founder and general partner at Social Leverage. All opinions expressed by Howard and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Social Leverage or StockTwits. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for decisions. Guests may maintain positions and securities discussed in this podcast.